Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Recent outbreaks of illness caused by contaminated food, including peanuts, raw cookie dough, underscore systemic problems in the nation's food safety system. Yesterday, the administration announced new measures to improve the safety of some foods, including eggs and fresh produce. Joining me in the studio to talk about new rules for food safety, Gardner Harris. He's science reporter for the New York Times. Carolyn Smith DeWall. She's director of food safety for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And Scott Faber, he's vice president of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. We do invite your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First joining us by phone is Michael Taylor. He's the FDA's new senior advisor to the commissioner. Good morning to you, Mike. Good to have you back.
Good morning, Diane. It's really great to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us about these new rules for food safety that were announced yesterday by Vice President Biden.
Well, the egg safety rule really is an important step in its own right to improve the safety of eggs. It's also, I think, a really important sign of where we're going on food safety as we work to modernize FDA's program. It's really all about, you know, looking at how eggs are produced and where the hazard comes in, where the salmonella can come into the process, and establishing those science-based controls that can be effective in reducing the hazard.
But so, what would these new standards actually do?
Well, for example, at the very beginning, the egg producers will be required to buy chicks and young hens from suppliers who've actually monitored for salmonella so that they're getting clean chicks and hens into the system in the first place. They need to establish preventive, so-called biosecurity measures to prevent the rodents, the pests, the ways in which bacteria can enter into a production facility, and then they have to use modern microbial testing tools to verify that the poultry house is clean, does not have salmonella in it. And so this is classic preventive controls to make food safer, and that's what this reg is all about.
Now, what about the examination of ground beef and lettuces in order to protect from E. coli?
Well, again, the lettuce, the leafy greens are certainly within FDA's jurisdiction. We'll be issuing guidance later this month that addresses how we reduce the risk of contamination from E. coli in produce. Of course, ground beef is under USDA's jurisdiction. They've got their own initiatives, and they're building on those initiatives to strengthen their testing, to strengthen their control of E. coli in ground beef. So, the egg safety rule is part of a broader set of initiatives that the administration is pursuing to make food safer. Again, need to understand this as a critical set of steps along the way to a real transformation of how we regulate food safety. We need to apply these science-based preventive controls across the board.
I gather that both the FDA and the Department of Agriculture are going to add new positions to better oversee food safety. How many positions are we talking about?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on here. I think what was announced yesterday included some new leadership positions, a chief medical officer at USDA in the food safety program, a new deputy commissioner for foods at the Food and Drug Administration to provide the added leadership capacity. Importantly, though, as the agencies, and in particular FDA, is getting some additional resources, and we hope with the president's budget being successful in for the next year and in subsequent years, we can build up the inspection force at FDA. I mean, this is one of the key capacity needs that FDA is working to meet, to be sure we've got adequate inspection coverage, which is critical to ensure compliance with standards. It's not sufficient for FDA to set these new modern standards it's got to have in place the inspection, the enforcement activity to achieve high rates of compliance with those standards. And so that's certainly an important part of the reform initiative.
Michael Taylor, he was named yesterday as senior advisor to the FDA commissioner. He recently has been a professor at George Washington University School of Public Health. Mike Taylor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Turning to you now, Gardner Harris, you have written that these rules announced yesterday are more aspirational than actual. What do you mean?
Most of the rules, most of the efforts that were announced yesterday are hoped for actions. The FDA talked about guidances that they will be writing for industry around leafy greens, around spinach, around lettuce, around tomatoes, around a lot of these foods that have been found to be contaminated over the last decade. But much more is needed than just guidances for industry. The FDA has to come up with actual regulations. It has to require these efforts. Same thing on the meat side. USDA is coming up with new efforts to clean up salmonella in chicken. They're going to start doing sort of better inspections of beef. But all of this requires real rules, real money, and real inspectors. And there's two ways to get there. One is that FDA has to write them. The other is that Congress has to pass the laws.
So how did the FDA rules announced yesterday differ from what the Congress is proposing?
So there was one actual rule, and that was the egg rule. Now, you know, what's remarkable about the egg rule is that it's been in process for 20 years. I mean, we have known for Ken Caroline, and Scott can talk about this probably better than I, we've known for 20 years how to fix this problem. And it's basically been bickering within the government.
Why?
Well, USDA kind of had oversight of chickens, but FDA has oversight of human health. There was sort of arguments going back and forth for through five different administrations about, who was going to oversee this. And it just never got done. Nobody ever made it a priority. And I think, the real issue here is that you need congressional leadership and you need people in the administration who their attention will not wander. And the problem in the past is that, even President Clinton actually announced that they were going to pass an egg rule. Well, the attention kind of wandered. It didn't happen. Mm. And all of these aspirational rules that we're hoped for in the future, are they going to actually happen? Is something going to happen? Is there going to be another war that's going to distract this administration? Food safety tends to get sort of to the bottom of everybody's pile. And Obama has said that he's not going to let that happen, but we'll see.
Gardner Harris, he's a science reporter for the New York Times. Turning to you, Carolyn, how unsafe is our food supply?
Diane, we have been experiencing a unique string of outbreaks and recalls coming in from products which I think are truly shocking to consumers. I mean, who would have thought that cookie dough,
which kids eat raw,
that sits
not
in your refrigerator.
Yeah, right.
I know. I actually was calling my family from Europe saying, throw it out, because, it was a shocking thing to have a food that is so processed and perceived as so safe, because so many people along the chain should have been looking out for us. But that was just one. I mean, we had the pistachio recall. We had the peanut butter outbreak. 9 people died from a product which is ubiquitous. It's everybody has peanut butter. And this is followed on a long string of outbreaks, very severe outbreaks, some involving thousands of people. And I think we've just reached a point where consumer confidence has really sunk to levels that I've never seen before.
All right. How much can we say is the responsibility of the consumer in perhaps mishandling or not treating carefully? And how much is the responsibility of the food manufacturers and processors?
So I think the best thing to look at is the food supply is a type of hourglass. Now, we can train, we can either try to address at every farm level, and there are things like eggs that have to be addressed at the farm. And that is significant in what the Obama administration's done on the egg rule, is it does go back to the farm. But the farms come in. Then we have, and it's increasing that our food supply is being sent through these central processors. And then it goes out to, it's distributed to people all over the country and really all over the world. So the question is, if we can put controls in place, do we want to train everybody at the bottom of the hourglass to handle every bit of food correctly? We will always have to train people. And it's a repetitive process. You have to always remind people of safe food handling. But if we can control hazards at that processing part component or on the farm, we will have a much bigger effect. And so that's why there's a lot of emphasis to finding the right point of control for these hazards in the food supply.
Caroline Smith DeWall. And she is Director of Food Safety for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Gardner Harris is science reporter for the New York Times. When we come back, you'll hear from Scott Faber. He's Vice President of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. I do invite your questions, comments. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. We're all worried about the food we eat because there have been so many problems in the last few years. In fact, 175 million people have been sickened in one way or another. Many have died. We've had outbreaks of problems with peanut butter, something that is a staple in many households. Now we have new regulations that are proposed, and the Congress is working on this issue of food safety. Yesterday, the administration issued an egg safety rule, and Vice President Biden promises more action on foods. Turning to you, Scott Faber, as Vice President of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, where do you see the suppliers in this whole process of food safety?
Well, I think Vice President Biden got it just right yesterday, where he said that we can do much more to make food safer, and that we can respond much more quickly when food breaks do occur. We manufacture food. We can't control what you do in your kitchen or what happens in your favorite restaurant, but we can certainly do more to continually make the food we produce safer. And we see this as this moment in time where this administration and this Congress seems really finally poised to act as a chance to raise the bar for our whole industry, including many of the smaller suppliers who don't have a brand to protect, but upon whom we depend for our ingredients. One piece of that is placing a new burden on our industry to do much more to police our suppliers. And one of the thoughtful provisions that Chairman Waxman and Senator Durbin and others have included in their bills is the notion that every food manufacturer, regardless of how big or small, will have to document in a food safety plan exactly what they are doing to police their foreign suppliers. So I do think we're entering a new era where we're going to be taking steps with government, with state governments, to raise the bar for the entire industry so people are doing much more to improve the safety of our
food supplies. Go ahead,
Gardner. Diane, I mean, what's remarkable, of course, is the reasonable-sounding nature of Scott over here. And, you know, what has happened in the last 10 years, I think, Diane, is that, you know, the large manufacturers have basically realized that this whole voluntary system that they had been pushing for so long doesn't work, and it messes them up because the smaller manufacturers who don't go along with the voluntary system sell a contaminated good, and then the entire industry goes down. So,
give me an example.
Well, in the tomato example, for instance, the entire tomato crop, $100 million tomato crop, got tossed, including the responsible makers,
because
a few irresponsible makers sold contaminated ingredients
here in this country.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing has happened with spinach again and again and again. Same thing with lettuce, again and again and again. Same thing with melons. And furthermore, and this is happening really across industries, as the growth in imports has happened, the domestic industry is starting to see, again, that it's even more difficult to corral foreign producers. And some of these food safety measures are actually sort of nice kind of protectionist controls. It adds something of a hurdle to cheap foreign imports to come into this country.
Now, a friend of mine went to a very well-known restaurant here in Washington the other evening. She had nothing but a Caesar salad with chicken. And
Was it the egg or the chicken in the Caesar salad?
Was up all night.
Or the leafy greens.
Yeah, she was up all night long. Now, how am I, as a consumer, to know when I walk into a restaurant, whether that well-known restaurant is serving lettuce that is somehow contaminated, whether eggs have not been inspected, or the poultry has somehow been mistreated? Caroline.
Diane, when we get to restaurants, actually the oversight of what's happening in the kitchen is being done at the state or county or even local level. And so this function, it's a very important function, but what we've found at CSPI, the Center for Science in the Public Interest, is the most effective state and local and county programs are those that actually tell the customer right on the door of the restaurant how that restaurant fared during its most recent food inspection. Now, the controls that we're talking about, the joint effort that's really happening both at the White House and in Congress, is going to control the safety of those ingredients. So the eggs that went into that Caesar salad in a year from now should be safer. The chicken, if the standards for salmonella in chicken are applied quickly by USDA, that should be safer. So the ingredients may be safer in a year or two if the government acts quickly. But what's happening in the kitchen and whether they're washing their hands and taking care of the dish the way they should is really at the state and local level. So we have really supported the concept. And in fact, we're thinking of a campaign in the District of Columbia to get restaurant inspection grades right in restaurant windows here.
Scott, tell me to what extent costs are a concern for the Grocery Manufacturers Association.
Well, let me start by saying that food safety is always the number one priority of food manufacturers. As Caroline alluded to, consumers have seen a decline in their confidence, and confidence is the foundation of our ability to sell our foods. If consumers lose trust in particular foods or brands, then sales go down. So companies have a powerful incentive to get this right. But it's important to keep in mind that this is a high volume, low margin industry, and everything we do to increase the cost of making food ultimately increases the price of food in the grocery aisles. We're not making toys or television sets. We're making something that everyone needs to survive. So as we move into this new era, the industry will take on lots of new responsibilities, new burdens. All of those things will increase the cost of doing business. We need to make sure that we don't do things that drive up food costs.
And
too much.
The government is calling for increased oversight. Yeah. Who's going to pay for that?
Well, that's an area where Caroline and I probably disagree. We think that it really ought to be the government's responsibility, the Congress's responsibility, to fund inspections. We don't think industry should be funding its own watchdog. Now, having said that, industry is willing to contribute more resources to FDA. Caroline and I have worked together to persuade the appropriators to increase funding. We've supported providing fees in the legislation that's pending before Congress, fees on industry. And I think where we differ slightly is on how industry funds ought to be used. We'd prefer to see those funds invested in things like science, rebuilding the agency's science capacity, learning more about how we could expand our traceability efforts, what use we might make of testing and so on.
Caroline.
Consumers pay every time they get sick. I mean, the bottom line is the cost of unsafe food right now are being borne by the people who experience illness. Some of them stay home from work. Some of them can't care for their kids. Some of them end up in the hospital. And the worst case is we see deaths as a result of this. So right now, the costs are being borne too heavily by the public. What's being considered in Congress right now is a mixture of a fee on industry. And I must say, Scott's been very successful at getting that fee to be the most modest that they could possibly achieve. But a fee, a $500 registration fee for some of these massive, massive companies, and then appropriations, which will have to come out and come away from other priorities. So we think we are going to be saving on the healthcare front if fewer people get sick. But there are going to be a continuing need for more appropriations and higher fees on industry to support inspection. One thing, Diane, that we haven't talked about is the fact that at FDA, their average inspection frequency right now is about once every 10 years. I mean, even for high-risk plants, they don't get in there except every, 2 to 3 years these
high
days.
High-risk plants being defined as?
Well, these are plants that might be
peanut butter now.
Peanut butter.
Yeah. But seafood, right. A lot of our seafood, actually a lot of it comes from overseas, but seafood is not inspected at all frequently. A lot of the highest-risk foods, things like dairy, it's all being inspected at the state level, shellfish as well. So a number of high-risk products, FDA's really turned responsibility over to the states, and they don't really have a good, effective system. So we need, as Mike Taylor said, inspection is really critical to an effective program. Michael Taylor, who used to work at USDA and FDA, he's been a food safety guru for many years. He used to tell me that an inspection mandate in legislation is the key to ensuring you have resources to going to inspection. So we've got that over at USDA. They inspect every meat plant every single day, but we don't have that anchor for resources at FDA. We would like to see the legislation that comes out have that anchor for FDA.
And the frequency in international food places, by the way, is once every 1,900 years on average. In other words, they are not getting to these foreign food plants at all. And, you know, what's going on here, Diane, is you know, industrialization and internationalization of the food supply. I mean, you know, in Great Britain, industrialization made life worse for most people in the first part of this century of industrialization, and then it made it better. And I think you could sort of say that industrialization of the food supply has really brought in sort of unknown factors in food safety
in this country.
And I think it's possible that the industrialization systems can make the food safer, but you have to get these rules in place, you have to get the testing in place, and you have to get the inspections in place.
How much support is there in Congress for the Waxman proposal?
There is huge support. It's passed the full House Energy and Commerce Committee unanimously. I mean, this is a monumental, really 100-year bill when it comes to food safety.
With just the $500 per...
That's right.
And let me clarify one important detail, which is it's $500 per facility but many companies have many thousands of facilities. And so some of the larger companies will be paying more. I think the important point is, as Caroline said, is this bill almost certainly will pass the full House, hopefully within the next few weeks. The prognosis in the Senate is a little bit less clear. And I know we share the same concern that, as Gardner said, there are lots of things that can wind up on the administration's plate or Congress's plate that will push this to the back of the stove.
But you still don't think $500 per manufacturing unit is sufficient?
No, the bill that it really is indicative. It's an inside the Washington game where they had a $1,000 fee in the legislation, and really due to, I think Scott should take credit for getting that cut in half.
Caroline Smith DeWall, she's at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and at 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Miles. You're on the air.
Hi. My sister works on a small organic farm in southern Ohio, and she says that regulations really hurt their business, and they deal pretty much exclusively in local distribution. And I'm just wondering what you think about consumer responsibility for health. And, like, you talk about knowing where things come from, but if you buy local food, you do know where it comes from. And so I'm wondering about what these new regulations are going to do for small local farms.
All right. Thanks for calling. Caroline.
I think the members of Congress have definitely heard from a lot of small farmers. And there is some concern here. The critical issue, though, is that if your sister is growing food for a local market, she largely will not be covered.
Affected at all.
No, even the egg rule exempts people with fewer than 3,000 laying hens. I mean, nearly all of these rules and regulations and the legislation exempts small growers
makers. Couldn't those small growers be equally at fault as the large agribusiness?
This is a real challenge, because it's not just small growers, but small manufacturers. Most of the companies that produce the food you buy in the Safeway or the Giant or tend to be actually the small companies that aren't familiar brand names. And I think in general, we don't want to set a lower bar for companies that are selling food into commerce. We need to make sure we're setting the same high bar, but we probably need to take some steps to ensure that small companies get technical assistance, get additional resources, so that they're able to meet that same high bar.
And the key for your caller's concern is if they're selling directly to the customer. So if it's the farmer to the customer, through your local markets, your farmers' markets, then it is a little bit buyer beware. But Diane, the good news about organic is that they've actually had some tougher standards for with respect to manure use and other things
imposed on them from the start.
Yeah, they have tougher standards that are not applied to traditional growers. So there is a bit of protection offered just by the organic.
But there's also a lot of urban myths going on around this legislation. Yes. And it's unbelievable what's happening on the internet about, as this legislation advances, some of the cattle growers are worried that they're going to have to come up with global positioning system devices for each one of their cows. I mean, there's a lot of bizarre.
Why?
Where explain this?
Where does that come from?
It's just unbelievable the amount of bizarre stuff out there.
Yeah, we have never seen, Diane, anything like this. There are rumors that the legislation will impact backyard gardeners. I can tell you, we are backyard gardener. It will not impact backyard gardeners.
Michelle Obama is also.
Right. It will not impact these very small suppliers. So the key is that everyone is responsible for food safety. Scott's right, and you're right, that the small growers are really responsible. But if they are selling directly to their own customers, they won't be impacted by this legislation.
We'll take just a short break here, and we've got lots of callers waiting. One person wants to ask about irradiation and the extent to which that's going to help make the food supply safer. We'll take that question when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A year ago, the cost of oil was more than double what it is today. In recent weeks, price swings have been dramatic. What's behind the volatility and the long-term outlook for global production and demand? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Lots of people out there have been wondering about cookie dough. Here's an email from Victoria in Rochester, New York, who says, "While I make cookies from scratch, I rather doubt the instructions on the cookie dough package suggest that eating it raw is an option. I would also assume that baking the dough in a 350-degree oven would kill off undesirable bacteria. I do not think the government should be in the business of protecting us from our own stupidity. As a taxpayer, I'd prefer that the FDA focus on risks that consumers cannot avoid, not ones their foolish actions bring on children."
It's a great point, because as we talked about earlier, there's not anything that we can do to control what people do in their kitchens.
But does the package say do not eat this dough?
It says cook before consuming.
Okay.
Three words. It's not one of the great strong warnings of all time, Diane.
But
and I'm sorry, but I lick my fingers. And if you look at the people who were sickened in this outbreak, mostly female, mostly young. And so it's the people who are preparing the food and it's the people who are eating the food.
But the same could be said, could it not, of dough that you prepare at home?
Well,
it's got raw eggs in it.
The key to the advice on cookie dough, Diane, really has traditionally been about raw eggs and this problem with salmonella in eggs. Cookie dough is kind of the classic example of something you make at home, you use raw eggs. Now the real question is, first of all, the pathogen we're dealing with in this cookie dough is E. coli 015787. We don't know where it came from. It's not in the eggs. We don't know how it got into the dough. I think this mystery has not been solved yet.
And it's a particularly dangerous
pathogen. It is deadly. I mean, it causes the failure of the kidneys. So it is really a very deadly pathogen, especially for children. So and elderly people. So we really need to be very careful to not blame the consumer for something. This isn't an avoidable thing like using raw eggs in your kitchen improperly. This is a fully processed product.
And the FDA said don't use it. It's not like the FDA said be sure not to lick your fingers. The FDA said throw the stuff out, because if it has E. coli 0157 on it, even if you handle it properly with knives and don't touch it with your fingers, there's a good chance you're going to smear the stuff around kitchen surfaces.
What about the caller's idea that if you cook it at 350 degrees, you're going to be fine? Is that true?
It's true, although I would rather see the test run in the kitchen. But the question is, what do you do with the knife? Did you wash the board you've just cut the cookie dough on? Because E. coli 015787 is too dangerous to have in your kitchen.
And
that's why they say throw it out.
And, of course, some people tend to undercook cookies, and there you have yet another problem. Let's go to Little Elm, Texas. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. My contention is that big agribusiness is really a lot of the problem. If you could even have local people doing cookie dough and that kind of thing. Apparently, you're saying that nobody knows where the E. coli from the cookie dough package came from. If it was a smaller business that was creating this, of course they're going to put more care into it, and there's a lot less chance of getting contaminated. In the past, 20 years since big agribusiness has taken over, you've pointed out that there have been several incidences of poisoning and death, which is really a sad thing. If farmers went to the local level, where, say, the local farmers selling it to restaurants, selling their product directly to consumers or to stores, I think that would help. Local county extensions could get in on the good practices, which they already teach farmers, and they could maybe help with some of the inspection burden, too, which also would create local jobs.
And, there are some restaurants here in the Washington area and certainly around the country where the restaurateurs do exactly that, go to local growers. They do their own careful inspection and so on. But she's talking about agribusiness.
Yeah, it's very hard to generalize about food manufacturers based on size. And Caroline, I'm sure, would agree with this. There are very big companies that have more resources that they can dedicate to looking for pathogens, training their employees, installing state-of-the-art technologies. There are very small companies that are doing a terrific job of implementing state-of-the-art technologies. And the right
but
way.
But what's in between, Scott?
There are big companies who can do better, and there are small companies who can do better.
And we learned this in the peanut butter outbreak. The Nestle people, oddly enough, they just had this cookie dough outbreak. But Nestle sent inspectors to those peanut plants, and the inspectors flunked the peanut plants. Nestle refused to buy peanuts from Peanut Corporation on America. On the other hand, Kraft happily bought a lot of peanuts from Peanut Corporation of America. Both of those large companies have a lot of resources, presumably to invest in food safety. One does, the other doesn't.
There are lots of reasons, Diane, to buy local. There are a lot of reasons, like freshness and taste, and you are supporting local agriculture. Unfortunately, and I monitor outbreak data. I mean, I've been monitoring, I've got 17 years of data that we've been looking at very, very closely, and we don't see any evidence that says local versus foreign foods are safer or less safe. We just can't tell from the data. So I simply, you know, there are lots of good reasons to buy local, but safety, we really can't tell whether it's safer or not.
It just means the outbreak doesn't go as far.
That's
all right. Let's go now to Cortland, New York. Zach, I gather you're a pre-med student.
Yeah. And I had a couple questions. And how do we know what exactly, when someone comes in with E. coli or salmonella, how do we know what it is that that they ate that gave them this? And are some foods just more high risk and they look to those first? And with the new cookie dough outbreak, should we fear for all of the food that we eat? Or and lastly, is organic safer? I know your one speaker said that she had a lot of data. Is organic safer, or is there any trend that we see in that? And how are all these new regulations going to affect organic growers?
Zach, you've got a whole class hour there.
Well, I'll handle the first one. I mean, so there is, as Caroline said, there is a huge difference between the local and state health departments across the country and how well they handle these sort of investigations. So the probably the best one is Minnesota. And they have an 18-page questionnaire that they ask people who have come in with foodborne illnesses about what sort of foods they've been eating over the last several days. And the most important thing, obviously, is that you get to these people as soon as possible because memories fade. People don't keep receipts, all those sorts of things. So Minnesota probably spends about an hour talking to someone, and they try to do it almost within the first couple of days of evidence of an outbreak. Places like Kentucky, which does this miserably, rarely calls people at all. And when they do, it's a very perfunctory conversation of, you know, do you know what you might have eaten? And that's it. So there is a huge range between the sort of epidemiological investigations.
What about in New York, where our caller is calling from?
New York actually has a pretty good health department, particularly in New York City. New York State is frankly not as good as the city.
I see.
But there was
Caroline.
There, Gardner is exactly right that there is a whole range from excellent investigations. But what we are finding is that as E. coli 0157 87 and some of these other pathogens get into more unique food products, it's taking the investigators longer to figure out what it is. So one of the announcements yesterday that the White House made is that they're going to develop a system, a much tighter coordination. We not only have multiple federal agencies involved in food safety at the federal level, they're then, because you've got CDC, FDA, and USDA, they're then coordinating through 50 states, more with our territories, and then a whole bunch of counties and state and local governments. So the coordination piece, I mean, coordination between the federal agencies is not good enough because they've still got to be able to coordinate all the way down to the local level.
Sounds as though it's going to cost you more than $500 per unit here.
You know, our industry is already doing a lot more with our own resources. When you add up all those $500 fees, they add up to about $200 million a year, which is roughly about a third of what FDA is now getting from Congress to attack this problem of food safety.
So what's remarkable about this problem, Diane, is chump change is invested in the food safety system in the United States. And particularly, as this caller is, you know, the surveillance system, trying to figure out what food is actually killing and sickening people, that whole surveillance system is done on a shoestring in this country. $50 million invested in surveillance, an additional $50 million, would make a huge difference. I mean, $50 million, we burn that in about 20 minutes in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it would make an enormous difference.
All right. To Indianapolis, Clarice, you're on the air.
Okay. While I don't expect any system to be perfect, what exactly does the FDA exist to do? I always thought they were here to serve, protect all of us by overseeing the manufacturing of food and drugs as well as food imports. But in the past few years, with all the food contamination, lack of safety, et cetera, what does the FDA do besides look after the financial interests and gains of big business?
Clarice, I think there are an awful lot of people wondering that same thing. Caroline.
You know, we have seen a huge decline in consumer confidence in the functioning of the Food and Drug Administration.
But why has this happened? Has it been the revolving door that Clarice is implying?
Well, I think the revolving door is not as big an issue as the last 8 years. We've had an administration that was simply loath to regulate. I mean, we had a presidential announcement saying that we needed to regulate eggs in 1999. And then there was a change in administration. And my understanding from people on the inside is that they had to go back and re-debate which agency was going to be in charge of it. They finally got a rule out in 2004, and it was just finalized yesterday. So 10 years to get a regulation out where there is agreement. There's agreement between the industry, the government, and consumers on what needs to happen. 10 years is too long, and that's what it's taken the government.
So are you saying that it's less the FDA than it is the government overall?
Well, I think the blame can go both to the administrations and to Congress. Mm-hmm. I mean, FDA has been starved of resources for 30 years. You know, in 1974, FDA oversaw something like 28,000 inspections of food facilities. Last year, it was closer to 5,000. I mean, the decline in the ability of the FDA to sort of oversee basic food safety functions is astonishing. And it's basically because Congress and the administration, I mean, no administrations have not proposed big budget increases, and Congress hasn't given it. And during the Bush administration, the only reason why FDA got any more money was that Congress forced it on the Bush administration.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Caroline, I gather what you're saying is that you have some optimism that this is the beginning if the administration can hold its focus to food.
It's critically important, Diane, that this be seen as a joint effort between the administration and Congress. The administration has to provide good leadership. Congress has to deliver both new authorities to the agency and new funding. It's really a partnership to get this done. The Food and Drug Administration has really suffered in the last 8 years, and they have robbed the food program sometimes to pay for other functions of that agency. This year, Congress added tobacco to their list. So the problems at FDA are not getting less complex. They're getting more complex. The management structure, we've got a great FDA commissioner there, but it's critically important that this partnership move forward now to improve food safety.
Scott. You know, I think your caller asked exactly the right question, which is, what does FDA exist to do? And that question is being answered in a different way than it has been answered before. Clearly, the agency needs significantly more resources and new authorities. But it's also important to make sure that the industry is encouraging industry to do more as well. You know, at the end of the day, government doesn't make the food. Food companies make the food. And you can write rules, you can inspect more. But at the end of the day, what companies do every day in their plants is what's going to make food safer.
So, Gardner, from your perspective, how can the ordinary citizen get involved in this issue?
That's a good question. I mean, I think they can talk to their representatives, make sure that food is a priority for the representatives. I mean, what I find remarkable is, You know, I cover the food, the FDA, and have done so for many, many years. And I write about drugs. I write, you know, the FDA covers a lot of different subjects.
Right.
But nearly every time that I write a food safety story, even about a relatively minor thing like this cookie dough story, it's immediately the most emailed story. I mean, people care passionately about food. But unfortunately, I don't think people in Congress hear that as much as they should. And I think that there is some real disconnect there between what people want and what the government hears that they want.
Well, what it seems to me we ought to say to people is how strongly you care will be demonstrated by your outspokenness on this issue, your willingness to take action on this issue by being in touch with your senator, with your representative, to talk about how concerned you are over the food safety issue. Thank you all so much. Gardner Harris, he's a science reporter for the New York Times. Carolyn DeWall Smith, she's director of food safety for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and Scott Faber, Vice President of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.